Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington that the government does not want you to know. And today's topic is America's healthcare crisis. It's often talked about, but not talked about in detail. And yet, you recognize it. You see that healthcare costs are going up, whether it's caring for yourself or for maybe aged parents, maybe for friends. It seems like costs are going through the roof, and yet I don't know that service is any better. We have HMOs making all the decisions. Doctors are complaining. They're not getting enough. What is going on here? How is it that patients are complaining about low service and high costs and HMOs, and doctors are complaining that they're not being able to get the same kind of responsibility they used to have? Whose fault is it? What's going on here? Is it HMOs? Is it insurance companies? How much of it relates to national politics? Do you remember the Hillary Care plan 10 years ago? How would that have fixed, maybe, the current crisis? Would it have solved it? What do you think? You know, there's so much going on with health care that the Bush administration has its recent Medicare proposal, and its proposal gives billions of dollars to pharmaceutical companies, but whatever it does to help seniors doesn't even take effect until 2006, maybe parts of it in 2005. And there's so much in it. There's the fact that you can't buy drugs from Canada, even if they're the same quality, that the government cannot negotiate better prices for drugs the way that HMOs can do. What's going on here? I want to know how the healthcare crisis has affected you. And I've got a terrific guest who's going to help explain some of these very difficult questions. His name is Dr. Alan Sager. He's the director of the Health Reform Program at the Boston University School of Public Health. And he's analyzed these questions, and I want to welcome him to the program. Dr. Sager, thank you very much for coming on the program.
You're welcome.
Let me ask you this. It seems like healthcare costs are increasing much more dramatically in the last 10, 20 years than all the many years before. Is that true, or does it just seem like it?
Some years are faster, some years are slower, but overall, healthcare is becoming more and more expensive. This year, we'll spend about four times as much on healthcare as we'll spend on national defense.
Now, is it increasing? Can you tell me, is it 5% a year, 10% a year, even more?
It varies from year to year.
Okay. All right. But it's definitely going up lately.
Yeah.
Now, what do you attribute that to? I mean, is it HMOs? Is it government costs? Is it drugs? Is it research? Is it just that people are living longer? Why is everything so much more expensive now?
Each piece bears a separate look. Certainly, prescription drugs have been the fastest growing part of healthcare, and drug spending has been doubling every 5 years.
Wow, doubling every 5 years.
That's right. This year it's $250 billion for prescription drugs. And most Americans know many of us can't afford today's drugs. And if drug spending keeps doubling every 5 years, very few of us will be able to afford the medications our doctors need to prescribe.
Well, let's deal with that issue first, just pharmaceutical drugs. And by the way, let me give out the phone numbers if you want to call in and say how the healthcare crisis has affected you. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number, 877-577-2667. You can also email me by sending an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Prescription drugs are, is it because people are living longer, or we have better cures, or is it pharmaceutical research? Why are they going up so much?
Some drugs are better. Drug companies raise prices on existing drugs. Drug companies market very heavily. The United States is only one of two countries where drug makers can advertise on TV and radio to patients. All these things make for higher costs. The other thing is that the drug makers of the world have come to depend on the United States for half of their worldwide revenue.
Wow.
American patients, who are 5% of the world's people, give the drug makers half their worldwide revenue. That's the $250 billion this year.
Now, you say it's half of the revenue, but are they half of the patients?
We're 5% of the world's people. We're not half the world's patients.
Right, but I would assume Americans get more health care than people in other parts of the world. Are we paying more for drugs than they are in Canada and Europe and other industrialized countries?
Oh, yeah. Our prices are much higher. Our prices are two-thirds higher than Canadian prices for brand-name drugs, for example.
Now, it's interesting you said there are two countries that advertise. I'm curious, what's the other country?
New Zealand.
New Zealand, okay.
Aren't you glad you asked?
I am. I had no idea. I am glad I asked. Well, and I'm curious also whether, I don't know if you've studied enough about New Zealand, but are their prices higher too, or is it just us? I mean, does the fact that advertising is allowed lead to higher prices?
With all respect to New Zealand, no one studies New Zealand.
Oh, okay. Well, I understand they got some great sheep there, so maybe they look at the wool. No, fair enough. I just didn't know if you knew. You know, what's interesting to me about the recent Medicare bill signed by the president is regarding prescription drugs is that he wanted to prohibit American patients from going to Canada and other countries to get their drugs. And, of course, it's charged that that's largely because that helps pharmaceutical company profits. Now, some people in the Bush administration say, well, they're worried about safety and things like that. Is there anything to that argument?
Essentially, no. The drug makers have been beating the drums about the safety of Canadian drugs, and the Food and Drug Administration has been doing the same. Food and Drug Administration has also said publicly that they have not found a single patient who's been hurt by Canadian drugs, and they've also said that they worry that importing from Canada will hurt drug company profits and therefore drug makers' capacity to finance new research, which would hurt Americans' health, ultimately, if all those things are true. The worry here is that the Food and Drug Administration, instead of being a referee, is playing on the drug makers' team much of the time.
You know what I find interesting about this is that the only jobs that the Bush administration really seems concerned about in terms of outsourcing is pharmaceutical company jobs. They're not concerned at all that we have people in Bangalore, India who are answering our computer phone calls all the time. They're not concerned that our industrialized, stuff is going abroad or that 9-year-olds are making Nikes in Thailand. But what they don't want is they don't want foreigners making our drugs. It's very strange to me. It seems to me very inconsistent.
Well, many of our drugs are already made in foreign countries. What this is about is whether the drug manufacturers are going to be the only ones allowed to import them.
The
desire to import drugs is a way to lower prices for Americans.
It's free competition. It's capitalism. I don't know why they don't support it, if they support capitalism.
It isn't. It isn't free trade and it isn't free markets. Drug prices are lower in other countries because governments control prices elsewhere, and we don't do that.
Now, one of the things I find interesting about drug advertising is if I turn on the news, I don't see too many ads for this drug will cure cancer or even this drug will help you through difficult chemotherapy or maybe a little bit on heart medication. I see all these ads for making you feel better, for Prozac and a purple pill, and I don't know all of them, but they seem to be mood-altering drugs rather than, let's say, life-sustaining drugs. Is there a reason? Is there more of that on the air, or am I just dreaming here?
Well, some people have said that lifestyle drugs and the kinds of drugs you describe are more frequently advertised. Because the drug makers depend for half their revenue on people in the United States, it's understandable from their standpoint that they would want to market the heck out of the American patient.
To get drugs that you might not need.
To build their revenue.
Right.
But this is part of a national strategy of drug makers providing particular kinds of information to doctors as well as patients. Sharon Brownlee, writing in the Washington Monthly in the April edition, and that's available online, Washington Monthly, April 2004, Sharon Brownlee summarized all the ways in which drug companies may be undermining the flow of objective information to doctors.
To doctors,
about
really.
What drugs to prescribe.
Not just patients. So how do doctors know what's to be believed? I mean, if you have a drug and the company tells you it works well or it solves a certain malady and it doesn't, are they lying to doctors or misstating things? What's going on?
if the drug company pays for the research and for the publication of the research and for the drug detailers who go door to door to visit doctors, questions are raised about the scientific accuracy of the research.
Dr. Sager, what independent research do we have? Is it in the universities? Who can we trust?
Well, under current arrangements, the evaluation of pharmaceuticals is not trustworthy.
Really? In the FDA, not either?
Drugs need to be evaluated by independent, objective people with no direct financing by grants or contracts from drug makers.
Well, that makes sense. And who's evaluating it now?
Drug makers do the work, or they have it performed under contract where they pay for the work.
So when
that is not an arm's length relationship.
Obviously not. Well, when the Food and Drug Administration approves a new drug, are they basing it entirely on the drug company's own research, or is there no independent objective verification here?
What would you mean by independent or objective verification?
I don't know. Someone other than the drug company. Someone other than someone paid by the drug company.
The drug companies do it or pay for it. And many of the people working for them under contract have very high integrity, and they call things as they see them. But some folks working under contract to drug companies might worry that if they report everything fully and accurately,
they won't be hired next time.
That's the threat.
I can tell you as a lawyer, I was a trial lawyer, and when you use an expert witness, you get various opinions, and lawyers pick the expert witness that they like. Sometimes it's you're picking the expert for their opinion rather than the expert really giving their opinion, and I can see how that might affect the drug industry. Let me give the numbers out again. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Do you think healthcare costs have gone up? Are you concerned about the pharmaceutical companies? How has it affected your life? Dr. Sager is here to help answer these very difficult questions. Dr. Sager, I wanted to ask you about some of the politics around this. A lot of people complained when Hillary Clinton had her plan back in 1994 that it was too complex, that no one could understand it, and of course it died in Congress. And I wasn't certainly working in Congress at that time. Can you help explain a little bit of what that would have done and whether you think that would have been an improvement over today's system?
What the Clintons proposed in 1993-94 was that all Americans would be covered, and that all Americans would have health insurance, first. And second, costs would be controlled largely through competing HMOs. And new money to pay for this would come from a bigger cigarette tax, and also from a requirement that all employers would have to cover their employees. Now, we actually got a lot of this. Not through congressional legislation, but through the growing competition among HMOs in the mid and late 1990s, where they were competing by price. Trouble was that patients and doctors and hospitals didn't like that very much, and we all pushed back, and the HMOs have largely stopped.
They've largely stopped competing with each other?
Stopped trying to squeeze doctors and hospitals or give them strong financial incentives to withhold care. And that's one of the reasons healthcare costs have started going up again.
Okay, but that's a reason that you probably wouldn't criticize. I mean, it's good that we allow doctors to provide the care they think is necessary, or I don't know. What do you think?
Well, nobody in this world, nobody can have a blank check.
Okay.
This year we're going to spend $1.06 in the whole economy on health care. 40 or 50 million people don't have coverage. Family premiums are rising to $10,000 or $12,000 a year in most large cities. We don't have a foundation for affordable care. And it's worth recalling that half the health care dollar is wasted.
One half.
One half of the $1.7 trillion we're spending on healthcare this year is wasted.
When you say wasted, you mean it doesn't go to doctors or patients? Where does it go?
There are four kinds of waste.
Okay.
The biggest kind of waste is clinical. That's incompetent care, or even more, unnecessary care, authorized by doctors, sometimes because of what's called defensive medicine, the fear that they're going to be sued, sometimes because doctors make more money when they provide more care. That's the fee-for-service arrangement that HMOs were trying to fight. In many parts of the country, we have too many specialists. In many parts of the country, there are not enough well-insured patients. And sometimes doctors can be tempted to provide more care than patients need. Also, even for problems like appendicitis or inflamed gallbladders, where the underlying pathology doesn't vary very much from place to place, the rates of surgery for appendectomy or for gallbladder surgery can vary by factors of 2 or 3. And the biggest predictor is the number of surgeons per 1,000 people.
More surgeons want more operations.
And this isn't, I mean, they're not necessarily thinking, how can I be corrupt and greedy? I don't think people are thinking that way. It's just that where there are more doctors, the clinical indications for doing surgery become lower.
In other words, if there were less doctors, they might say, well, you can suffer a little pain and live through it, and you don't need the surgery?
Well, we're not necessarily talking about suffering a little pain. It's just that the clinical thresholds for when the surgery is appropriate can get lower when the doctor supply becomes higher. But so the clinical waste is the biggest area. Then comes administrative waste, second area of waste. We have more paperwork in the United States than any other country's healthcare.
And why is that?
Oh, complexity, too many different payers, too many different forms, too many different procedures, too many different drug formularies, also mistrust. So many people in the United States make more money when they give more care. Other people make money when they give less care. When there's mistrust, someone wants to check up on you.
I see.
So they have you fill out paperwork. Also, with 40 or 50 million people without insurance, someone has to check on whether you're eligible and what you're eligible for. So there's the paperwork. Then we also, the third source of waste is high prices for drugs, for durable medical equipment, for some salaries. And the fourth kind of waste is fraud and theft.
And one half of every drug care dollar is wasted.
One half of every healthcare dollar.
Right. Let me go to the phones. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Dr. Sager. What's your first name and where are you from?
Hi, this is Bert from Minnesota.
Hi, Bert from Minnesota. How are you?
Doing well. I got a question for Dr. Sanger. He was saying how there was one of the evidences of waste, and I think he heard that he said it makes up one of the largest parts of the waste, is the clinical waste. And he specifically cited appendicitis, saying to wit, in areas where there are more surgeons, that you're going to have more appendectomies.
Factor of 2 or 3, right?
So, I have a couple of questions about that. The first thing is, one, where there's an area with a lot of surgeons, there's little magical things come and happen called a center for excellence. So you've got basically a big hospital with lots of surgeons.
So people are traveling 200 miles to go see the surgeons.
To get the surgery
All right.
there.
That makes some sense.
So I disagree with him that evidence of waste is that more surgery is being done there than, say, in, Protection, Kansas.
Okay, well, before you get to your second point, Bert, let me ask Dr. Sager to address it. Dr. Sager, isn't it possible that if there's less surgeons in Idaho and more in California, that people from Idaho are traveling to California to get care?
Well, sure. But what happens is, when these studies are done, these factors are allowed for.
Okay, it's controlled for that.
So the rates are calculated by where people live.
Not by where the doctors are.
Right. But that's a very good question. And the studies have tried, I think, pretty well to deal with that.
Okay, Bert, what's your second point?
The second thing is, it's odd to me that appendicitis is being used as a mark sucker for waste, you know, in as much as, you know, you're operating too much for appendicitis. Because in medical school and in fact in surgery,
right? Are you a doctor, Bert?
I am a doctor.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
They teach us that to operate on appendicitis and be wrong, and it not being appendicitis, is acceptable up to, depends where you're at, but generally around 10 or maybe even 15%. So the point being that the complications of not operating can be devastating. I mean, you've got a big intra-abdominal infection, you know, blood poisoning.
So it makes sense to be defensive sometimes. Is that what you're saying?
It makes sense
to err on the side of
a very hair trigger for operating on appendicitis. Why is that being used as a marker for too much operations going on here?
I think it may just have been an example, but I'll let Dr. Sager respond.
Yeah. Thank you for another good question. These variations from county to county and state to state have been studied for many, many diagnoses or presenting problems. And I agree with what you said about wanting to be cautious. Caution wouldn't explain a 2- or 3-fold variation in surgery rates. Incidentally, it isn't just surgery. The same or greater rates of variation in hospital admissions are found for medical problems.
In other words, not just surgery like appendicitis, doctor. When you say medical problems, you mean in all kinds of...
Exactly.
I see. Well, he's got some good statistics for you, Bert. Do you not trust? I mean, do you think that do you have a different view of healthcare in America than Dr. Sager does? Do you in terms of cost or waste?
Well, I don't have the data to marshal here. You know, I'm trained in surgery and not epidemiology. But I have to say, on the whole, I agree with him.
Okay.
That there is waste. I mean, the fact that people come to an emergency room where, you know, the financial stakes are high. You know, it costs more to get care through an emergency room, even if it's primary care, than through a primary care office. I agree. That's waste. And that is clinical waste. And a lot of his markers and data that he marshaled, I agree with, and his conclusions. There were just some...
I think those were great questions, Bert.
When he cited appendicitis as a wasteful surgery, it just red flagged it.
Fair enough. I certainly didn't mean to say that appendicitis was wasteful surgery, and I'm glad you picked up on that. And the real challenge, I think, if half the healthcare dollar is wasted, is to squeeze out the waste and recycle it as clinical bone and muscle to take care of people.
Bert, if you hang on for me, I need to go to a break. But when I come back, I want to go through some of Dr. Sager's possible solutions, or at least ways to reform this massive problem, which sounds very grim, frankly, from someone who's not a doctor, is the only one not a doctor here on the line. It sounds very grim to me. And I'd like you to stay on, Bert, because when I hear Dr. Sager's proposals, I want to know how you, as a doctor, would react to some of them. So if you'll hang on for me, we'll get back to more of Dr. Sager and more of America's healthcare crisis, and hopefully some way out of this morass, because it sure sounds scary to me. We'll be back with more of the Inside Scoop. If you want to call in and join in this discussion, it's always welcome. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. If you want to email, the email is comment, C-O-M-M-E-N-T, at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
If a thief broke into your home and stole a couple of $1,000 that you had carefully saved from your paychecks and stashed away over the last 3 years, you could call the cops and try to get your money back. But who do you call when that thief is the CEO of your company? CEOs have been routinely stealing hundreds and even thousands of dollars from the deserved paychecks of each and every worker in America, pocketing much of this loot themselves and converting the rest to corporate profits. The grand larceny of the CEOs is that they've been filching every worker's share of the enormous productivity gains that America has racked up since the recession officially ended in November of 2001. Productivity is the increase in products or services that each worker churns out. And Americans have been phenomenal at this, fueling an explosion of new economic growth. The theory and promise of free enterprise is that if our workforce of millions of people becomes more productive, the workers will enjoy the bulk of economic gains generated by their improved output. Yet in this current three-year burst of productivity, America has lost jobs and wages have either stagnated or fallen. In other words, America's working families are being fleeced by the pinstripe thieves sitting atop corporate headquarters. Workers' share of the new income they've generated in this recovery is the lowest ever recorded, while the fat cats have hauled off the most on record. An in-depth analysis by the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University finds that while the workforce usually is rewarded with 65% of the increase in national income, this time they've received only 38%. Profits, which go overwhelmingly to only a few investor elites, usually get under 18% of the productivity increase, but now they're getting more than double that. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is a massive historic level of theft, and the pinstripe dandies pulling it off ought to be wearing prison stripes.
Toyota owners, roll into summer with great tire service offers at your participating Toyota dealer. And keep rolling all year long with free gas from Toyota. That's right, Toyota is giving away free gas for a year to 12 lucky winners. Just come into your participating Toyota dealer, where you get the very best competitively priced service performed by Toyota trained technicians using genuine Toyota parts. Come in today and enter the sweepstakes.
No purchase necessary. Ends May 31st, 2004. Void or prohibited. Open to legal U.S. residents 18 year old with valid driver's license only. Void in Hawaii. Official rules at Toyota.com/owners.
This report is sponsored by Pfizer and Viagra, sildenafil citrate. You've seen the signs as they leave the doctor's office. The spring in the step, the look of relief, spontaneous whistling. The technical term for this condition is, what took so long-itis? In layman's terms, it's what happens when you finally ask your doctor about Viagra. To experience the skipping, whistling, and sense of relief, ask your doctor about Viagra and if a free sample is right for you. To learn more, go to Viagra.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. We're talking about America's health care crisis. I have really a terrific guest, extremely informed. He knows his stuff. His name is Dr. Alan Sager, and he's the director of public health at the Boston University School for Public Health. And we had a little bit of unintended irony there in that we actually had an ad on the air for Viagra. Those things happen. Do you think, I'm just asking because, hey, I heard the ad. Dr. Sager, do you think that Viagra is prescribed a bit more often than is necessary?
Who knows? That's the first answer. The second answer is, Americans are spending $250 billion for drugs. All of us should be able to get the medications our doctors honestly think we need, have evidence that we need for that money. We spend enough to take care of all the prescription drug needs of all Americans now and protect biomedical research. And this is the easiest problem to fix in the United States. It's a tragedy that we haven't found a way to do that.
Okay, it's the easiest problem to fix in the United States. Go ahead, give me the solution, because I'm not sure I see it. Is it importation? Is that the solution? Competition?
Without a free market, there's not much in the way of competition. I like the free market, but Bible says we're not supposed to worship a golden calf, and without a free market for prescription drugs, it's not too useful to talk about one. See, because it's imaginary, not real. Importing? Well, importing from Canada tells us that low prices are possible. But right now, what we probably need to do is, in the United States, we don't have to import price controls from Canada. We don't have to wash our pills in a Canadian laundromat to get them clean. We can lower prices right back here by direct government action.
Would that be price fixing, to use a negative phrase? Is that
it's called price controls.
Okay.
Because there's no free market for prescription drugs. The drug companies have been controlling prices.
Now, why is there no free market? I mean, why can't Viagra compete with another company? In fact, I think there is another company, I don't really remember, but that also has a similar drug. Why isn't there free competition?
Well, first of all, you have a patent.
Okay.
Patent is a monopoly.
That's true.
If someone else has a slightly different drug, they can patent that. But
I mean, doesn't aspirin compete with Tylenol, compete with ibuprofen?
Right, and those are not prescription drugs.
That's
second,
true.
They're not under patent. And they're made by lots of people. Prescription drugs are often made by just one company, and they can charge pretty much what they want.
What if we were to change patent law? I mean, actually amend the law to lower the length of time that a patent exists. Drug companies would say that would harm their research.
Mm-hmm.
Would you support modifying patent law, and would it harm their research?
Well, dealing with patent or dealing with importing from Canada or dealing with generics or other things like that or bigger copays are pieces, or drug discount cards are pieces of the puzzle. But most of these are just, I'm afraid, skirmishing around the edges. We don't need skirmishing around the edges. We need a drug peace treaty, and that entails just a few simple things. First, much lower prices. But second, a guarantee that the drug makers recoup the revenue that they lose from lower prices through higher volume. So you lower prices, but they make it up in volume, which means that their ability to finance research is not harmed.
Well, we
get all the meds we need. They get the money to finance research. And that's why this is the easiest problem to fix.
One of the things that we could do is really treat them the way we treat utilities. I know that my electric bill, my gas bill, they're all regulated because they're sort of natural monopolies. And we make sure the utilities get a certain percentage of profits, but they're very strictly regulated. Is that sort of the model you see, Doctor, or do you see some other model?
I think that's half of it. The difference here is that we want the drug makers to compete. Incentives count. We want them to compete to come up with a drug for Alzheimer's or something that makes the low-density cholesterol in our blood go away or that preserves and restores cartilage in hip sockets so we don't need artificial hips.
Can I ask a question?
Drugs are good when they work.
Hang on 1 second, Bert. Let me just finish this point, and then I want to hear your comment very much. Finish, Doctor.
Sure. So we want competition, and we want good rewards, but we want the rewards to go to drug companies that genuinely come up with valuable new innovative medications.
So how do you structure a system like that?
Well, you keep a lot of competing drug companies in business, and you share risk with them. And then when they come up with something good, you give them a big bonus, maybe billions of dollars. But that's because new drugs, say for Alzheimer's, would be worth many times what we'd pay the drug companies.
But it sounds like what you're proposing, and let me just maybe this is a label maybe conservatives might put on it, but it really is sort of a national healthcare system where you have the government price fixing and deciding who to reward. And is that fair, or have I overstated it?
Since we don't have anything close to a free market for prescription drugs, and since more and more of us can't afford our medications, and since high drug prices are making more and more Americans real angry at the drug companies, and since we do need much bigger investment in breakthrough research, without a free market, unless government gets heavily involved, we'll have pharmaceutical anarchy. And that'll make the anarchists happy, but for the rest of us who need medications, we need affordable drugs, and we need more breakthrough research, and we can get both.
Well, I think you make a strong, persuasive point. Before I get to my doctor hanging on the line, I want to hear what he thinks of your point. Let me give out the numbers again. It's 877-57-SCOOP. Do you think that it's time for a national health care in the way that Dr. Sager suggests? He makes a very strong argument. 877-57-SCOOP. You can also send me an email to comment, COMMENT, at RadioInsideScoop.com. All right, Dr. Burt, we got you on the line. What do you think of Dr. Sager's proposal?
Well, it's definitely intriguing. The thing I was struck most by was that whenever you drop the cost and you increase the volume, one of the things I thought about was, well, what are you going to do about upstart drug companies? And I'll give you an example. I did research on a new form of cancer chemotherapeutic, and it was by this, I hate to use the word mom and pop when it comes to health.
A small company.
It was very small, yeah. I mean, it was like half a dozen PhDs and an MD, but I mean, we were really developing a new drug. And I'm sitting here thinking, okay, the way things are now with low volume, high cost, this company could reasonably recoup its loss. But, you know, now all of a sudden he's proposing these changes, which I think are very intriguing. But the first thing I think is, doesn't that rule out upstart drug companies?
Yeah, Dr. Sager, what about the benefits of scale? I mean, are we keeping out new companies by this proposal you have?
I don't think so, and I certainly wouldn't want to. If a new small company comes up with a good idea, the approach I'm talking about is actually going to be very beneficial to them because they'll be guaranteed that a new product is going to be identified and rewarded in the market without the small company having to license or franchise the results of its research to one of the giant drug companies that have the big marketing staff to peddle the pill.
So it just makes a good product, and then the government worries about marketing. It might even be easier because all you have to do is show the government you've made a good product, and then they take it from there. Is that sort of how it works?
Yeah, and you wouldn't really have to show the government, but there'd be an independent body that would objectively evaluate which drugs are good.
Now, the independent body appointed by the president, Congress, like the Fed, is that sort of what you have in mind?
Well,
I'd like to see it open sourced myself.
Beg pardon?
Completely. In computer industry, there's a movement called the open source industry.
You mean sort of peer based?
Oh, it's peer based and transparent. You know, so like if someone makes a program that supposedly, you know, downloads things faster, but meanwhile it's monitoring your credit card numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, some programmers who do nothing but hack all day would see this and put it out and say, hey, there's a problem.
I presume, Dr. Sager, that all the research and so forth would be open for peer review.
Well, sure. But the difficulty here is that very few of us have been to medical school.
I haven't.
And it's hard to evaluate all this stuff. We need to pay for drugs, and we need to pay for research, and we need to pay physicians in ways that encourage us to trust doctors.
Well, but you've just given Dr. Sager all these reasons why we shouldn't trust doctors. The first part of the program, I thought the things you were saying were very grim, that more doctors means more operations, and doctors get paid more if they have more treatments. I mean, I like to trust my doctor, but the things you told me at the beginning of the broadcast make me quite nervous.
Well, I'm glad you picked up on that. In today's world, most doctors make more money when they provide more care, and some will be tempted to provide more than we need. The challenge is to do a few things. One is to recognize that pathology is remorseless and resources are finite. Healthcare has never saved a single life.
That's true.
That's cool.
But it's prolonged quite a few deaths, I hope.
And I think that's a wonderful goal, and that's why we're spending $1.7 trillion on it.
Okay.
And that's good. The challenge, of course, is to recognize that we only have $1.7 trillion, and it's enough to provide all the care that all of us need. But when we bring doctors together and say, doctors, here, a few hundred doctors, say, and you've got a few hundred thousand people to take care of, here's $1 billion, make it last for 12 months and come back to us next year. So doctors have to think carefully about who really needs the care. So we're not going to perform unnecessary surgery. We're not going to drop pacemakers into the chest of 96-year-olds who are dying of metastatic cancer.
I want to understand your proposal, though, Dr. Sager. It's very interesting. I understand the concept. The concept is we want to make sure that doctors don't spend wasteful money on procedures that aren't necessary, like you say, like a pacemaker in a 96-year-old. But how do you give doctors a set of funds and limit it? I'm not sure I understand the mechanics of what you're proposing.
Well, some of the managed care ideas could be made to work better for us. The first thing would be that there'd be two pools of money. One would be to pay doctors, and one would be to pay for hospitals and prescription drugs and nursing homes and home care, and the other things that only doctors can authorize. So, and these two pools of money are in separate watertight compartments. So doctors get paid, here's the money, doctors divide it up among yourselves in proportion to competence and energy and kindness. And then doctors, you have to marshal the money in the other pool, in the other watertight compartment, to take care of all these patients and work it out and see you next fiscal year.
Well, but wait a minute. I mean, who's working it out here? I got to tell you, in politics, details matter, and it really matters whether it's the AMA or individual doctors or some politicians or some health board, and then there's going to be people lobbying that health board and trying to get it to do more Viagra because that helps Pfizer. I mean, it all sounds good in theory, doctor, but, you know, I know enough about politics and checks and balances that it doesn't always work the way it says in the textbooks. How do we prevent misuse?
You're right on target. First, there have to be standards that patients who have this problem, well, this is this presenting problem, here are some general guidelines for diagnosis and for treatment. In other words, evidence-based medicine.
Sounds like the Cochrane Index.
Cochrane is good.
Okay, well, you have to explain that because I don't know what it is, and I'm sure my listeners don't, except those that are doctors. What is Cochrane?
Go ahead.
Please go ahead, Bert.
Okay. Yeah, it's a group of people basically review it's a standards. It's an ongoing, constantly under review standards for blank, whatever.
Okay,
blank
standards
is.
For medical care. So if you have if your blood pressure is at a certain level, then you need a certain medication.
More or less. Yeah.
Okay. For laymen like me and for my listeners, let me give out the number again because I don't want to just encourage – this isn't just among doctors, though frankly I'm learning a lot here and I hope you are too. But I want to hear from anyone who wants to talk about the healthcare crisis. You don't have to be a doctor. You just talk about what's going on in your life. 877-57-SCOOP. Dr. Sager has made some very interesting proposals. They're quite strong, quite radical, and yet they may be a solution. We have to go to a break, but when we come back, I want to bring this back to a little bit of, if you'll hang on with me, Bert, too, I want to bring this back to a little bit more of politics. I want to know whether Bush's proposals will do any good, whether Kerry's proposals will do any good. Is there anybody in Congress that's looking at what Dr. Sager's proposing? Is this just a bunch of people in the academy giving up maybe some great ideas, but, you know, no one's really doing it? What is going on here? The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number, 877-577-2667. You can also send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Back with more of this very interesting discussion. Really, some of the first proposals I've heard to actually fix the severe healthcare problems we've been having. I don't know, though, if sometimes you wonder if the solution is worse than the problem. Call in, let me know what you think. 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. All charges have been dropped against anti-war protesters and a South Carolina longshore official arrested in the port of Oakland a year ago. American President Lines and Stevedoring Services of America were being picketed for war profiteering. Charleston Longshore Unionists participated in several anti-war rallies and were attacked by riot-clad police at the behest of the maritime companies.
On May 11th, by a 59-40 vote, the United States Senate rejected an amendment to a corporate tax cut bill that would have extended federal unemployment insurance benefits to a growing number of Americans out of work for 6 months or more. Assuming the one absent senator would have voted yes, the fight would have at least lived another day, but as of now, the effort's officially dead until after the November election. The missing man was Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry, who was out on the campaign trail in Kentucky. A Kerry spokesman says the vote was meaningless as GOP leaders in Congress had vowed to kill the extension by any means necessary on the grounds that it would have added more red ink to a budget already swimming in it.
The future of overtime pay protections is still threatened. On Wednesday, House Democrat George Miller offered a motion stating that any worker currently eligible for overtime pay would not lose it under new regulations announced last week by the Bush administration. But he was stopped by Republican Majority Leader Tom DeLay. The Senate approved a bill that contains two bipartisan amendments to protect employees from the overtime pay regulations. Barring congressional intervention, the changes, which would eliminate overtime pay for up to 8 million workers, will become effective in August.
British firefighters are threatening another summer strike unless last-minute provisions added by the government to a laboriously negotiated national contract are dropped. The fire brigade's union especially objects to changes which could lead to reductions in benefits for overtime work and rest periods. The union's so angry it suspended its national conference this week and told delegates to go out and rally the rank and file, possibly for action beginning in July. Last June, the British military took over fire service in the country for 2 weeks as firefighters picketed.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A new study by a Washington-based organization, The Sentencing Project, found that the number of people serving life sentences has increased dramatically over the past decade, even as the nation's violent crime rate has fallen. Since 1992, the U.S. has seen an increase of 83% to more than 127,000 inmates. The study attributes the rise in life sentences to mandatory minimums and three strikes laws.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're really in a very interesting discussion on America's healthcare crisis and really some interesting proposals for reform that I haven't heard before really take a good hard look at the problem. But I don't know if they're too radical. I don't know if they go too far. You know, they said Hillary Care went too far, Hillary Clinton's proposal, and that's why it didn't go anywhere. And yet Dr. Sager's suggestions go even farther than that. I've got a doctor on hold. That's Bert from Minnesota, and we can always bring him back in the program. I do want to go to another caller hanging on the line and see what that person says. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Dr. Sager. What's your first name and where are you from?
Jeff from Denver.
Jeff from Denver. Are you a doctor too or not?
No, but I come from a family with a lot of medical practice.
Okay, no, I want to hear from some non-doctors. I feel outnumbered here. Go ahead. What's your comment or question, Jeff?
One thing we need to look at in reforming things is there are three main points about drug companies. One is they are one of the most, if not the most profitable business. You know, their percentage of profit is higher than almost any other industry.
Okay.
Secondly, so they have a lot of headroom there. Secondly, a lot of the research is paid for by the government, not by the drug companies themselves.
Good point.
And third, a very high percentage of their money is spent on marketing to doctors and perks to doctors, some of them which are illegal. So if we actually just enforced existing laws in that, we could reduce costs there.
Okay.
So there is a lot of room for the drug companies to get less money and still be quite profitable.
And I'll bet Dr. Sager agrees with you. Is that right, Dr. Sager?
Absolutely right.
Yep. I think we can all agree on those three things. Jeff, let me ask you, do you think that Dr. Sager's solution to really have government, since there's no free market anyway, which is a very strong point, that government needs to control the profit levels and basically dole out money in airtight compartments to decide how to spend it? What do you think of that solution, Jeff?
Well, yes, I would agree with that. The single-payer system, I think, is very important. It's one that has been shown to... I believe that's essentially what he's saying.
Is that what you're saying, Dr. Sager? Is that a single-payer solution? Is that a fair way to describe what you're suggesting?
I think the single-payer approach is the first step of about five big ones we need to take. Single-payer will cover everybody, so we no longer have Americans suffering medical insecurity and worry about being able to pay the bill. And second, we pool all the money in one place, so we really cut administrative waste.
Now,
but the challenge after that is to spend money carefully and make sure that doctors and hospitals and drug makers are held accountable to take care of all of us with the money we've got.
Dr. Sager, how would your single-payer proposal, if that's largely what it is, differ from, say, that in Canada or in Europe, in France, and other countries? Is it fairly similar, or are there significant differences?
Well, in several ways, I think this approach is different. First of all, it's hard for one country to simply imitate another. The challenge in every country is to make it possible for us to trust our doctors to spend money carefully, to take care of all of us. And single payer by itself, I worry, doesn't do that until you take the second step, which is to figure out how to pay doctors, how to pay hospitals, how to pay drug makers in ways that hold them accountable for living within a budget. And the great thing is, we spend twice as much as the average wealthy country per person on health care. So when people say, oh, the Canadians or the British, they wait in line for care, that's nonsense, because you have to compare apples with apples. We have the money inside healthcare to take care of everybody. We simply have to liberate and oblige all of our doctors and hospitals and drug companies to take care of us with the money we've got.
Jeff, do you got any more? It sounds like you agree with Dr. Sager. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would. And we especially have to look at, I think, the things that are absolutely essential for life, that we have to, as a society, protect them. That one is, you know, water and things like that. You know, we shouldn't be privatizing water. Healthcare is one of the essentials in life, and I think the American crisis is so much worse than people realize. One simple way to show people is ask two questions. How many uninsured people are there in the United States? And the answer is like 43 million or 40 to 50 million.
Yep.
Then you ask them, how many uninsured people are there in the rest of the industrialized world? And the answer is zero.
It's a very strong point. Hey, Jeff, thank you very much for your call. I got to tell you, I got a similar email from Gordon in Michigan, who talks about, he says, at least with catastrophic drugs, can't catastrophic drugs be price controlled to save those most in need? It seems those are the ones that are most exploited. I mean, it seems to me clearly that there's a big difference between drugs you need to save your life and drugs you need to make lifestyle drugs, let's just say, as Dr. Sager pointed out. Thanks very much for your call, Jeff. I appreciate that. Dr. Sager, I wanted to ask you, I got another email from Sheila in Pittsburgh, and she says, why not just remove profit from the healthcare picture entirely? She writes, it's a profane that healthcare companies make a profit on the illness of others. She says, no health insurance, no HMOs, state-run hospitals, drug companies that do R&D and sell their patients to sell their patents to the state to manufacture the drugs, with doctors and nurses independent contract employees of the hospital system. What do you think of Sheila's proposal?
I think most people work harder when they have incentives. The saints among us will work hard no matter what. But for the millions of people inside healthcare, good motivation, incentives and rewards for working harder and for doing a better job and for learning more and becoming more competent will pay off.
Okay.
Profit, I don't think profit is that big a problem inside healthcare. Not that much money really goes for profit. Certainly the rate is highest for prescription drugs. And we can spend money better.
Let me ask you, I said I wanted to bring politics into it. This is a political show. We try to bring news from Washington. What is being proposed in Congress, if anything, along the lines of what you propose? Do you think that John Kerry would be better than George Bush on health care? Maybe you think Kerry doesn't go far enough. Give me the politics of your proposal.
Well, unfortunately, the president and this Congress don't have an approach to health care except taking away insurance and asking them to spend more of their own money in hopes that if we have to spend more out of pocket, we'll spend more carefully. This is truly stupid for several reasons. First, a lot of people don't have more money to spend out of pocket. Second, most of us haven't been to medical school, and it's hard to shop carefully for health care.
Doctor, you're breaking up. I'm not quite sure why. Is it on your end, too?
I can hear some static on the line.
Yeah, I don't know why that static's there. Oh, well, keep going. So Bush and the current Congress have really no solution. Is John Kerry better?
Well, what Kerry wants to do is have the federal government absorb some of the cost to make health insurance premiums more affordable for employees and for employers, and also to find ways of covering uninsured people. Now, that's certainly a step forward.
Okay.
But there are no cost controls there. Covering people is the emergency right now. All Americans need coverage. And a lot of people think that once everybody's in, once everybody's covered, then we can start turning our attention to containing cost. And politically, that might be right. I'd be happier if we tried to do them both at the same time. It's a little bit like driving a stick shift car. You have to work the accelerator and the clutch together.
Let me ask you this. Let me give Dr. Burt's been holding this whole time. Let me just see if he has any last comments, and then we got to close up soon. Dr. Burt, thank you for being so patient. Any last comments before you go?
Yes, to enthusiastically endorse Dr. Sanger's last point. Basically, to use another thing that I do with evolution creation controversy, what we need to do is intelligently design a big change that we can't afford to evolve it. I mean, the example given was that we need to do a single payer, but then that prevents, you know, big profits from really good drugs. Well, then you need the other thing to take care of that, and I mean, we really need to do a huge, big change at once.
Okay.
I don't think any of the things he's proposing you can do it and not be radical.
Thank you very much for your call, Bert.
Thank you.
I'll tell you, I hear it, and I hear what both my doctors, Dr. Sager, the director of public health at Boston University School of Public Health, what my Dr. Bert from Minnesota are saying. I got to tell you, as someone who watches politics a lot more than medicine, that it's very hard to do radical change in politics. It's almost impossible. It seems that we've learned in the Clinton era, you can do good things evolutionarily, piece by piece, bit by bit. That's largely what Clinton did. He was in fact mocked for his micro proposals, and yet he did move America step by step, inch by inch, in a positive direction. I've got to tell you, just as someone who watches Congress a lot, I don't know how we could possibly get to a proposal like yours, Dr. Sager. I don't know if you have any political ideas.
Well, the idea is to start in the states. The states used to be the laboratory, but right now they're locked up and there are dust clouds on the lab equipment. Congress has to liberate the states to try different things. One of the reasons the Clinton plan failed was that a lot of people had no confidence it would work because it had never been tested in the states. So let's try different things. Let's tinker, because Americans are tinkerers.
So let the individual states start it up first. I know there's a plan, and we only got a minute left, but there was a plan in Oregon recently where they took all the health care needs of people, put them in order of most serious to least serious and most cost-effective to least cost-effective, and then paid for a certain number of them. What do you think of the Oregon plan?
That's one approach. Different states might want to try single payer or other arrangements. The challenge is for doctors and patients to learn to work together, to spend money carefully and expect what's realistic for $1.7 trillion, which is all the health care we need once we squeeze out the waste.
Dr. Sager, this hour went very fast. I learned a lot. I got to thank you. I really think you not only described the problem in great detail in a way that people could understand, but actually gave some very interesting creative solutions. Thank you very much for coming on The Inside Scoop.
You betcha.
Thanks again. Hey, look, tomorrow we've got, excuse me, tomorrow, there's no show tomorrow. It's Saturday. But all next week we've got a bunch of good shows. And in fact, on Monday, the 17th, you may know that gay marriage will be legal in the United States for the first time. Before then, there were marriages performed in California and various other states. It's not clear whether those will legally survive. But this Monday, May 17th, in only 3 days, gay marriage will clearly be legal for those that live in Massachusetts, and at least for the next 2 years before there'll be a constitutional amendment. And I'm going to debate those that are most against it. James Dobson's group, Focus on the Family, is sending a representative to my show, and we're going to have it out, and you can bet fireworks will occur. I hope you'll tune in Monday for that show, and all the time for the Inside Scoop. Listen, independent radio only exists through your support. Radio Power plays my stream. If you can give them a donation, it's appreciated. And also, check out RadioInsideScoop.com. Check out my website. It's really terrific. It's been newly designed, and one of the nice things you can do on it is comment on the show. If you're hearing an archive, for example, you haven't had a chance to hear the live show, here's your way to go ahead and comment and read other people's comments. Just go to RadioInsideScoop.com and add what you say to the blog. And if you like the Inside Scoop, again, please don't keep it a secret. This is Mark Levine signing off.